Welcome to The Machine, a computer science education podcast from the Southeast Technological University of Ireland. I'm your host, Rob O'Connor, from the Department of Computing and Mathematics at SETU. This episode is the first of our themed shows discussing women in technology, coinciding with International Women's Day on the 8th of March and Women's History Month. It also leads up to a Women in Tech event that we're hosting in SETU in Waterford on the 21st of March 2024. Today, I'm speaking with a Spanish computer scientist, Nuria Oliver, who specializes in artificial intelligence, human-computer interaction, and mobile computing. During her career, Nuria has worked with MIT, Microsoft, Vodafone, Telefonica, and more. At present, she's the chief data scientist with the DataPop Alliance and is also a co-founder of the Ellis European Lab. She's also a fellow with the Association of Computing Machinery, the ACM, and more on that in a moment. I very much enjoyed chatting with Nuria, and I learned a lot from listening to her thoughts on topics such as how big data can help reduce inequality in developing countries, or discussing issues around bias in AI systems, as well as gender and diversity imbalances in the industry as a whole. Now, Nuria communicates in a very easy to understand way, and I think all listeners will benefit from hearing what she has to say, whether you're a seasoned professional or a computing novice. And this interview is also the first time The Machine podcast has collaborated with another group, the ACM, Association of Computing Machinery, the largest organization in the world advancing computing as a science and a profession. And my thanks to the ACM crew in New York for putting Nuria and I in touch with one another. It's kind of funny when you think about it that a group in North America had to get together to put a woman in Spain in contact with a guy in Ireland so that they could record a conversation and then put it out on the internet for anyone and everyone to hear. There's links in the show notes to specific projects and initiatives mentioned during the conversation. So without further ado, here's Nuria Oliver. I hope you enjoy listening.
Hi, I'm Nuria Oliver, and the focus of my research is on developing intelligent interactive systems and developing models, computational models of human behavior using machine learning techniques to invent technology that understands people and therefore can help people.
I'm going to start by asking you a question about a TED talk that you did about 10 years ago from a TEDx event in Barcelona. And the title of the talk is My Cell Phone, My Partner. So it's what I found most interesting about the talk was the way you framed it as a story. So you frame it as a story about two people, Leonardo and Sheldono, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. I mean no offense. One is a physicist, the other is an artist, and it's about how their phone helps them throughout the day with the various things that they're getting on. Now, what's quite interesting about that is, first off, it's 10 years old. So we can now see this with the benefit of hindsight. But even though, say, some of the technologies that you mention are now outdated or have been superseded by other things, what struck me about it was the way you framed the technology around assisting people, around a story, and trying to posit how this can be useful for people in their everyday lives. Now, how do you feel about that kind of a description of your TED talk?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that you like the storytelling part of it, I guess, because that was one of the main purposes for the talk, to emphasize how we constantly interact with technology and how the mobile phone is the most pervasive, you know, piece of technology used today. And it has this power of being a great helper to each of us because we spend more time with our phones than with anything or anyone else in our lives. And in that talk, I tried to illustrate, you know, the example of how it could adapt to the different users, depending on their personalities and depending on the kind of person and the needs, you know, that they had. And of course, you know, that was probably, you know, a lot harder to do 10, 15 years ago than it is right now with the big advances in artificial intelligence. But I think it reflects well my vision of technology being a tool to help people, both individually, like in that example, is helping individuals, but also collectively. Since 2008, I've also worked in the area called data science or big data and AI for social good. So how large-scale data can help us make better decisions that impact the lives of millions of people, many of them in the context of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. So how can we leverage AI to have, you know, better education? How can we leverage AI to mitigate poverty? How can we leverage AI to combat climate change, you know, and so forth?
And is this through the DataPop Alliance? Would that be the main vehicle through which you're working with this?
Well, I actually, it all started when I was scientific director at Telefonica. This was one of the areas that I created and with some of the researchers from my team. And we did projects in Latin America, projects related to financial inclusion. For example, we invented a method called MobiScore to allow the unbanked people that don't have a bank account, there is about a billion people in the world that don't have a bank account, to be able to have access to credit through the analysis, obviously with their consent, of their mobile phone usage. And we discover that the mobile phone usage could be could serve as a proxy for your how trustworthy you are in terms of your finances and your credit. So with this project, we built a credit score based on the mobile phone patterns as opposed to financial transactions patterns, because these people don't have a bank account and they're outside of the financial system. But we want to help them be able to have access to credit, because we know that credit is a gate instrument to allow people for their own prosperity and to enable them to, you know, buy a cow or create a small business, you know, and make a better living. We also work on projects related to poverty, socioeconomic status inference, and also infectious diseases and pandemics. At the time, it was the H1N1, you know, flu pandemic. When I joined Vodafone as a director of research in data science globally, being very passionate about this area, I also created the area of data science and AI for social good at Vodafone. And in this case, we worked mostly in projects in Africa. We worked also on financial inclusion and on infectious diseases, specifically Ebola and malaria. Mm-hmm. And in parallel, as you very well said, since DataPop Alliance was created, I was very passionate about the mission and the vision of DataPop Alliance. And then through DataPop Alliance, I've also collaborated in other related projects. So I've been working on the area, you know, from different, I guess, fronts and collaborations and institutions. And now at Ellis Alicante, we also work on the area of AI for social good.
So as you're talking about things there, Nuria, what I'm hearing is big ideas being translated to, when I say small initiatives, I don't mean small in terms of impact, but what you're talking about there is microcredit, for example. You're not talking about somebody who's unbanked getting a small amount of money, maybe like you mentioned, to buy a cow or to buy a sewing machine or whatever it might be. You're not it's a small initiative that can have a huge impact on somebody's life. And I do think that's quite interesting how data plays a role in that. So could you give me an example as to how the data or how the data science can drive somebody being able to get microcredit to buy a cow or a sewing machine or a bag of tools or whatever it might be?
Yeah, so there are different ways, and we actually I worked on two different types of data, two different types of projects. So the system that we built that was meant to be used in Latin America, even though it later inspired a very big Indian group company, and they actually created a company to do something very similar to what we were doing with this project. The main idea is to analyze data related to the usage of the mobile phone network. So we have to understand that while there are more than twice the number of mobile phones in the world than people, and more people have access to a mobile phone than have access to drinking water or to proper sanitation. In many cases, we are not talking about smartphones. We are talking about feature phones. We're talking about the, I guess, Nokia phones that we used to have, you know, before the smartphones took over. But in any case, so all these phones are connected to the mobile phone network. And the mobile phone network consists of a network of what is called base transmitter stations or cell towers. So in all these projects, we analyze the data captured by the cell towers. So it's not data captured at the device level. It's not data captured by any app or within the phone, but it's data captured by the mobile network. Mm-hmm. This data, of course, is a lot less granular and a lot less informative than data that you could capture with an app, but it is very universal. It's available to every device. And by analyzing the historic information about the patterns of usage of the mobile phone and different kinds of features that can be extracted from that, as I said, obviously with the consent of the person wants to apply for a credit and wants to demonstrate that they are trustworthy. So we were able to, using machine learning algorithms, build an algorithm that would infer a credit score about the person, and that could enable the person to have access to credit, which they wouldn't otherwise. But other area where you can also leverage data and machine learning to support financial inclusion is in the context of mobile money, which is very prevalent in many countries in the world, including many African countries. So one of the leading systems of mobile money in the world is called M-Pesa. It was a very pioneering system because it allowed individuals that only had a feature phone and they only had SMS and the feature phone to be able to do financial transactions via SMS, to be able to transfer money, to be able to pay for utilities, to be able to do a number of things that you in the developed world, you would either need a bank account and make a bank transfer, or you would need a credit card, you would need any other kind of like financial instrument. And again, using machine learning methods, we did a project to understand the factors that were driving the adoption of mobile money with the goal of fostering the use of mobile money for a larger portion of the population, because it had all this positive impact in enabling people to perform all these kinds of like financial transactions that were very difficult to do otherwise. So there are different, I guess, tools, different kinds of data that can be used to enable individuals who are outside of the traditional banking system to be able to be participants, you know, in some kind of like, you know, financial activities, and to be able to have access to credit, which is, as I said, a very important element to enable any person to be able to sort of like prosper and grow.
You mentioned there the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And as I look at the Datapop Alliance website, which is datapopalliance.org, and there's a link to it, I'll put it in the show notes as well. I see that you've got three pillars of work: diagnosing local realities and human problems with data AI, mobilizing capacities, communities and ideas towards more data literate and inclusive societies, and transforming the systems and processes that underpin our datafied communities and countries. I can see how those could map to the Sustainable Development Goals. Has that carried on through to the work that you're doing in Ellis?
Yeah, so... Well, we do collaborate a little bit with Datapop Alliance, but I think we operate in very different, I guess, realms, so to say. So ELIS, which means the European Laboratory for Learning and Intelligence Systems, is a European grassroots initiative promoted by the European machine learning researchers with the goal of contributing to Europe's technological sovereignty and leadership and competitiveness in AI, recognizing that Europe is lagging in AI behind North America and Asia, particularly China, and recognizing that one of the challenges that Europe is facing is difficulties to attract and to retain the best minds in AI. because there is a huge demand of talent, and most of the leading research labs in AI are actually based in technology companies, and those technology companies are not located in Europe, or they are not European. So we are having this sort of like brain drain situation. And with ELIS, we are hoping to contribute to reverting this worrisome trend, because we also know that the most valuable asset for any society is its talent. And we really want to invest, you know, in the talent. So ELIS Europe has four pillars to achieve this vision of contributing to Europe's technological sovereignty in AI through talent. And one of the pillars is what is called the ELIS sites, which are research teams that meet certain criteria for scientific excellence, because ELIS is all about scientific excellence. It's about like the top people, because those are the people that have a lot of job offers. And those are the ones that, you know, are very, is very difficult to retain or to attract. So the ELIS units are these excellent research teams that meet this excellence criteria, but they also commit to contributing to the mission of ELIS by offering competitive salaries, very flexible working environments, fostering collaborations within the network, and so forth. There have been maybe, I think, it's 5 competitive calls for the creation of ELIS units, and there is right now 41 ELIS units in 16 European countries and Israel. And one of those ELIS units is the ELIS unit in Alicante that I direct. The ELIS unit in Alicante is special within the network because it is the only ELIS unit that has been created from scratch as a nonprofit research foundation. And that's why ELIS Europe calls ELIS Alicante a startup unit, because it's like a startup unit. And the reason why it's been created from scratch is because it's trying to attract talent to a region and an area where the talent wouldn't naturally come otherwise. Mm-hmm. ELIS Alicante is also special within the ELIS network because it is devoted to a very well-defined topic, which is research on the sort of like responsible and ethical AI for social good. So anything related to what is called human-centric AI. So in terms of the theme, we do obviously have an overlap or a relationship with Data Pop Alliance, which also has a very human-centric vision, you know, on using data and AI, you know, for sustainable development and for social good. But in ELIS Alicante, we do academic research. We, you know, publish scientific papers and so forth. And Data Pop Alliance is a lot more focused on working directly with institutions, with other NGOs, with governments of countries to actually address, you know, specific problems and develop specific projects. We also have an ongoing collaboration with Data Pop Alliance because about a year and a half ago, 4 institutions, including ELIS Alicante and Data Pop Alliance, we created Nexus, which is a network of AI for sustainable development, where a lot of the members of the network are institutions in the global south, institutions in developing countries, and where with Nexus, what we want is, on the one hand, to place a lot more focus and emphasis on the opportunities that AI brings for sustainable development. And on the other hand, we want to contribute to closing the digital gap and the knowledge gap between, you know, the North and the Global South in terms of AI skills. Mm-hmm. So those two objectives are very aligned with some of the activities and objectives of Data Pop Alliance. And that's why, you know, Data Pop Alliance is one of the co-founders of Nexus, and we are another co-founder of Nexus. So we have this sort of like synergies, you know, between us. But ELIS Alicante is a lot more focused on the scientific side of things and belonging to a scientific network of excellence and focusing a lot on having PhD students and publishing in scientific, you know, academic conferences and journals.
You're clearly very passionate about the work that you're doing. You are. You can take it as a compliment. I wonder if we could maybe zoom out and have a think or explore what got you started into all of this in the first place? So if we could maybe kind of zoom back a few years and maybe think about, how did Nuri Oliver get into technology in the first place? What was it that sparked your interest in computing in general?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So I don't come from a technology or scientific family at all. I come from a very humanities-oriented family. My dad is like a philosopher and Latin to Spanish translator, so it couldn't be more humanities. my mom is also in humanities. But I always, since I was very small, I've always been fascinated by puzzles, logic problems, difficult things to do, anything that is unsolved, that is a question, that is a mystery. I've always been fascinated by this idea of like discovering something or inventing something. And I've also really liked science. I didn't have any close references or role models, but I always thought, oh my God, you know, Marie Curie or Leonardo da Vinci or Albert Einstein, you know, it was like, I thought they were fascinating figures. So through high school, I always chose the scientific technological branch of high school because I really liked physics and maths and, you know, all the scientific subjects. But I really didn't know what to study. I didn't know what engineering was about. I had no idea. I had never programmed in my life or anything like that. And when I was in the last year of high school, I had a chance to meet and talk to one of my brother's friends who had started studying telecommunications engineering in Madrid, in the Polytechnic University of Madrid. And he had come to Alicante, which is my hometown, for Easter holidays. And so I had a chance to talk to him during the Easter holidays. And for me, it was the discovery of what engineering was about, of what technology was about. And he explained to me which classes there were and, you know, what all these very unknown concepts to me, you know, meant. And I found it so inspiring that I decided that I also wanted to study telecommunications engineering, also in Madrid. So I remember coming back from that meeting and telling my parents, I know what I want to study now. And my parents were like, what? I was like, well, telecommunications engineering. I'll be like, what is that? I'm like, sounds fascinating. So I basically decided to do that. I guess I've always been very lucky in my life that my parents have always supported me in whatever I wanted to do, even if they didn't really fully understand, you know, what it was. When I was studying telecommunications engineering, it was a six-year program. So it was like a bachelor's plus master's degree. And I guess it was in third year, maybe fourth year, one of the math professors invited me to write a paper for a conference in Italy. And I don't know exactly how, but I decided to write it about artificial neurons versus like human neurons, you know, biological neurons. Mm. And so through that project, I learned about AI. And I always say it was love at first sight because I thought it was incredible that we could invent algorithms that would like learn something, you know, because I find biological learning, I find it such an incredible skill that, you know, all biological beings, you know, that we have. And thinking that you could actually make a machine learn something, if it was something very, very simple, you know, for me, it was like magic. So I wrote the paper about that and it was accepted. So we went to Italy and I presented the paper. And then I decided that I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to be a researcher working on AI. So I did my master's thesis on computer vision, which is one of the areas within AI. And my dream was to be able to go to the US to do a PhD in AI. But, you know, I didn't know anyone that ever did that. I obviously didn't have the financial means to be able to do that. And I was lucky that I learned that there were these very prestigious, very difficult to get scholarships given by La Caixa Foundation to do postgraduate studies in the US. And then I said, well, I'll apply because it's my only chance. So I applied for that and I was lucky and they gave me one of these grants. And then You had to apply to the US universities like any other student. So the grant is, it was just in case they accept you, then they would like provide the financial support. And well, it's a long story. I applied to 7 universities and they actually accepted me in all of them, which was completely unbelievable. And eventually I chose to go to MIT and that's where I did my PhD. So I never ever could have thought when I decided to study telecommunications engineering that one day I was going to be, doing a PhD at MIT in artificial intelligence. Yeah.
Wow. So did your experience of telecommunications, technology, computing, mathematics, data, all of that, did it match up to the expectation that you had as that young teenager going into your parents saying, I know what I want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it like really blew my mind. Like I was probably one of the people in the class that knew the least about technology coming in. And maybe because of that reason, because everything was so new to me, I was just like constantly like opening my eyes, like, wow, I can't believe you can do this. Oh, I can't believe you can do that. So for me, it was really a very inspiring experience. I mean, it has the reputation of being a very difficult degree. I did 2 specializations at the same time, but I loved it. I felt I was so lucky to be able to have the opportunity to learn all these things. And, you learn a lot of hardware, but you also learn a lot of programming because I did one of the specializations was like the one that was the closest to computer science. So it was almost like doing computer science. And I didn't know exactly. It's not that I had very clear expectations, but I would say it was an extremely rewarding experience. And for me, it was definitely my discovery of technology and the power that technology has and the possibilities that it brings. And a lot of the things that I'm saying, I think, are very obvious today because we coexist with technology. Everyone is exposed to technology. You know, we can't live without it, right? But at the time, it wasn't the case, and we didn't have technology constantly impacting our lives. So for me, it was really the discovery of these instruments and these disciplines that we could really use to do really cool stuff and help people and understand people. And so it was really an amazing discovery.
There's a well-known gender imbalance in engineering, technology, computing. And there's a whole variety of potential reasons as to why this is. I'd like to focus on maybe a positive question, or I'd like to present a positive question to you, which is, in your opinion, what can we do to have more young women enter into these technical disciplines?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So I guess
it's not an easy question.
Not at all. No, I mean, if it was easy, I guess we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't. So I mean, I think to answer the question, we probably need to reflect a little bit on the reasons why, because probably, you know, depending on the reasons, you know, there might be different actions that we can take. So thinking about the reasons, I think there are 4 really big kind of like types of reasons. And each of them requires different, you know, solutions and different plans. So the first kind type of reason is related to stereotyping, to the fact that, you know, when we close our eyes and we ask any random person, okay, close your eyes and imagine a person whose job is to program computers, you know, no one is going to imagine someone like me. I mean, people are going to imagine whatever they've seen in movies and in TV shows or they've read, you know, in books, which is usually like a guy, you know, with glasses, not particularly in shape, in some obscure basement in front of some weird, you know, screens doing something strange with very poor social skills, etc. And that's definitely not the reality of it, but that's the collective, you know, image that we have of it. And that stereotyping is obviously not very attractive to anyone, and even less so to girls or, you know, female teenagers. And also there is a stereotyping in how these disciplines are being taught. And in fact, there's a number of universities that have changed the way they teach computer science. And simply by changing the way they teach it, they are able to attract and to retain more female students. For example, instead of focusing on programming for the beauty of programming, maybe focusing on programming as a tool to solve problems that really motivate, you know, the students. Or grouping the students by prior knowledge of programming, so the ones that never took programming in high school don't feel that they are lagging, you know, behind, and things like that. So that's one set of problems. So the stereotyping challenges require a collective cultural societal effort, because it is a societal and cultural, you know, factor. So, you know, from the media having a role to play to really break down, you know, these stereotypes, to obviously schools also playing a role, and, you know, raising awareness also with the families and the parents, which many times might be the ones that don't encourage, you know, the female students to pursue these types of careers. And then, as I mentioned, you know, the educational institutions changing the way they teach, changing the way they present, you know, the material can also help. The second set of reasons are due to a cognitive bias that we all have, which is a gender bias. And according to this bias, all of us, men and women, we tend to undervalue women that are at the same level of skill as their male, you know, peers. This is a cognitive bias that we apply to our own selves if we are women, and we apply to, you know, other women. And the reason why this cognitive bias matters in the context of technology is because usually in some countries, for example, in my country, engineering degrees have the reputation of being very difficult. Math has a reputation of being very difficult. You know, physics has a reputation of being very difficult, and so forth. So we have a situation where even the top students in high school, which in many cases, in most cases, are actually female students, because girls tend to do better in academics than boys, they kind of like self-censored themselves, like they don't choose these degrees because they feel that they won't be good enough, even though they're actually the best in their high school, because of this gender bias. And this is something that we need to be aware of, and that we need to combat, and we need to sort of like give a little push, you know, if we realize that this might be a factor that is preventing a lot of girls from choosing, you know, these degrees and these careers. This gender bias also applies to, for example, like risk-taking behaviors and so forth, where again, girls are a lot more discouraged, you know, than boys. The third set of reasons is related to visibility and recognition. There is still a gender pay gap in many countries in the world, including in the technology sector, and there is a lack of visibility of role models, of, and in this case, female role models in these fields and in these degrees, right? So again, if we pick a random person from the street and we ask them, okay, tell me a prominent figure in technology, they're probably not going to say the name of a woman. They might say Steve Jobs, or, I don't know, Elon Musk, or Mark Zuckerberg, or Bill Gates, you know, or one of the like founders, you know, of the technology companies, but probably with very low probability, like they will actually mention the name of some woman. So, but there are a lot of women that work in the sector and that are doing amazing things, but many times they're doing them in the shadows because they don't get the visibility, you know, that they probably deserve. So we really need to balance a little bit the types of role models that we have, so the next generations of, you know, boys and girls, they feel related, you know, to role models in a variety of fields. And so a solution to this would be a lot of like visibility actions. A podcast like this podcast might help, you know, so I think communication actions, you know, are helpful. And in terms of the recognition, we do have still a lot of work to do. I mean, if we look at the statistics, for example, of the Nobel Prize winners in the areas that are sort of like STEM, so in medicine or in physics, or in chemistry, there is still a huge gender imbalance. I think 97% or so, I think, of the Nobel Prize winners in those categories have been men. but there are more than 3% of brilliant women probably working, you know, in those fields today. So we really need to make an effort of having diversity in the juries, diversity in the pool of candidates, so we can have diversity in the pool of winners, you know, of different recognitions. And the last family of reasons is actually very specific to the technology sector, and is related to the culture of the sector. There is a culture called the programmer culture, programmer being the intersection between the brother culture and the programmer. And it's a very sexist, misogynistic culture where it is very much accepted to openly insult women or undervalue women or make fun of their work. And it's a very aggressive culture against women. There's been a number of lawsuits in the U.S. because of this, you know, sexual harassment and very aggressive culture, which is obviously completely unacceptable. But unfortunately, it has driven a lot of women away from the technology sector because they can't deal with being in such an aggressive environment, you know, for so long. There is, these things have changed. I mean, this was really bad, say, 10 years ago, and it has improved in recent years because I would say now all the companies have diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and they really make an effort. But it's still prevalent in some areas of computer science, and it's obviously something that we need to be aware of, and we need to, you know, have zero tolerance, you know, for. But it does cause attrition, female attrition in the sector, when already we have, as I said, a very small percentage of women that choose these degrees in the first place. So every, you know, woman is very precious, and we shouldn't lose any of them, you know, that are working. So it's a complex matter. But at the same time, you think about it, I mean, we technology permeates everything. Computer science is probably one of the most versatile disciplines that there is, because you can apply to any field. You can apply to education, to communication, to medicine, to transportation, to finance, whatever field you are interested in. Today, it has technology, and it can leverage, you know, computer science. It can leverage AI. So I would say is the most is the kind of knowledge and discipline that allows you to work on any other sector and any other field, and is very family friendly because historically you can just work from home. I mean, in most of the cases, you just need to have good computing capabilities, you know, good networking, and you can do a lot of the work from home. So in terms of like work-life balance and so forth, is probably one of the best sectors, you know, that you can be in, especially compared with other sectors like education or medicine, where there is a lot of women, and it's very, very hard to find good work-life balance in those cases, especially in medicine, because you have to be on call, you have to be physically in the hospital, you have to be physically in the clinic. It's not that you can just easily, you know, work from home. So the computer science field, the technology field, has a lot of positive attributes that we should also make more visible, so we can attract more diverse individuals to it.
Yeah, you make some really excellent points there. And I was, as you were talking, loads of stuff was popping off in my head, but I didn't want to interrupt you because you were in full flow.
Sorry, and I
it was brilliant. It was great. But I mean, there's a number of things there that I just kind of want to come back to you with, because I think they're so interesting. So like your last point about aspects of, I'm going to say the computing industry or technology industry that we don't think like the. So many, say, of my friends or my colleagues in the tech sector often don't work in the tech sector for itself. They're working on projects that are medical projects or whatever. Or actually, one that's very big in Ireland at the moment is agricultural technology. And like 20 years ago, I used to make jokes thinking I was hilarious about agri-tech, and what a fool I was, because that's now absolutely huge, and it's helping us as humans to grow more sustainable food, to grow better food, and to help us feed ourselves. And it makes a huge amount of sense for the species going forward. And I suppose when you talk about careers where you can feel maybe you have an impact and it's not just technology for technology's sake, getting those kind of stories out there are probably might maybe assist in attracting more people into the sector.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we do need a lot more diversity, but we also do need a lot more individuals, period. I mean, there is an anticipation of like hundreds of thousands of new jobs in Europe, for example, in the computing sector that we don't know how we're going to fulfill because we don't have enough people that have the skills to fill them. So we are living in this very, a little bit paradoxical situation where on the one hand, teenagers can't live without their mobile phones and they can't live without their technology, but then they are not choosing to study, you know, computer science as a field. So they see themselves as users, not necessarily as creators or not necessarily as feeling capable of using that technology for creating new things or solving problems that are relevant to them, right? And I think this is something that we also need to try to change as a society to inspire them into seeing, wow, you have this hyper, like super powerful computer in your pockets, you know, a lot more powerful than what I was using when I was starting to do my PhD. And I was managing to get, you know, the computer to like recognize facial expressions or whatever. And each of us has this super powerful computer that we don't really use given the capabilities that it has. At the end, what do we use it for? To take pictures or maximum videos and share them in social media and send text messages, maybe listen to music. I mean, not that much given the capabilities that it has, right? And imagine if all the teenagers in the world that have a mobile phone were thinking about it as a tool to make the world a better place, to come out with some innovative idea, to solve a problem that they have, you know, it would be amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of, there was an initiative in Ireland a number of years ago for in 2020. It was called the 2020 campaign, and it was geared around greater female participation in sport. And it was about 20%, the goals were to get 20% greater media coverage of female sports, 20% more funding, and I think it was, I'm going to say 20% more attendance at live matches and games and things like that. Now, I could have some of that wrong, so I'm just thinking off the top of my head. But now it obviously got interrupted by COVID, okay? But there's been a massive popular rise in female participation in sport. And I wonder, maybe, is there something along those lines that we could perhaps do for the technology industry? I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good idea. I mean, I think you're making a very relevant and interesting, you know, analogy, because it's obvious that if we set ourselves to it, we can do it.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, there is a classic example in terms of gender bias, which is symphonies. Mm. You know, decades ago, symphonies were all men. I mean, to the point that it was actually thought that women were unable to be virtuosos when playing an instrument. And that's why the logical conclusion was that the men had to be the ones that were like the musicians in the symphonies. Until, you know, there was a symphony that decided to do blind auditions where you wouldn't see the musician playing the instrument. You would only hear the music to try to prevent, you know, from potential biases. They had to refine the system a little bit because the first trial, even though the judges couldn't see who was playing the instrument, they could hear, and the women were wearing high heels, so they could know whether it was a man or a woman because of that. But, you know, eventually they refined the system, and today we have a lot more gender equality, right, in symphonies. And, of course, no one would ever dare to think that women are not able to be, you know, virtuosos, you know, playing instruments. So if we want to, I think we can change things. I think so initiatives like the one that you mentioned for sports, you know, is an example of how if we take action, you know, we can actually have actual change in society. And, you know, for many years I've been saying, you know, it's time for action. I think we know the situation and we know that if we do nothing, it's not going to change. It's going to get worse. So it's time, you know, to act.
We haven't really got into AI in too much detail, and I don't think we will, because there's enough talked about AI elsewhere. But there's obviously a huge issue about bias in AI systems. It's well documented and it's well known. And to help combat that, I mean, we do, as you said, need more women, more diverse computer scientists, more diverse people feeding into these systems to help to combat that. So if AI is going to have the trajectory that some people say it will, it's kind of crucial, really, for the success of potentially humanity. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, algorithmic discrimination is actually one of the areas that we work on in Ellis Alicante, or algorithmic, I guess, justice. So it's a very big field within machine learning, within AI, the field of measuring and mitigating algorithmic biases and discrimination. We have to think that increasingly so, machine learning algorithms are going to be supporting or maybe even making decisions in consequential areas in humans' lives. For example, medical diagnosis, medical treatments, judicial sentences, educational opportunities, job opportunities, you know, automatic filtering of like CVs, granting of social, you know, programs and social services. There are many examples that have come to light on how algorithms have been used in those scenarios and how those algorithms were actually, in many cases, not only replicating, but exacerbating patterns of discrimination that there are in society. And that's why the field, you know, is so important and it has grown so much, the field of algorithmic discrimination or algorithmic fairness. So we do work on that in Ellis Alicante, and we have invented some methods that definitely improve the fairness of the algorithms. And we also have another line of work that is a lot less explored, but to me is really fascinating, which is the interplay and the potential that AI has to help us humans be less biased. I just gave as an example the gender bias. We humans have around 200 cognitive biases, and those biases impact our decision-making constantly without us knowing. And those biases are necessarily not good for us or for society, you know, in many cases. At the same time, you know, we are surrounded by technology and potentially, you know, by AI systems. So, you know, could we leverage AI to help us humans have a better understanding of our own biases? And also another question that no one really knows is, when we interact with an AI system, say I'm interacting with a chatbot, you know, or a personal assistant, do I have the same cognitive biases than when I'm interacting with you? We don't know. And then the other question is, do I expect the system to have the same cognitive biases than humans have to be more natural, to be more human-like, or should it not have any bias? Because, of course, the biases are not necessarily good. So there is really a lot of unknowns in this area, and it's an area that we are investigating, and we started with one particular cognitive bias, which is the attractiveness halo effect. This is a cognitive bias that says that what's beautiful is good, good-looking people tend to be perceived as more intelligent, more trustworthy, more sociable, more hireable, less likely to be a criminal. They receive better job offers. They are more likely to get promotions. They receive better sentences, like judicial sentences. So basically there is all these like positive, you know, advantages that you have if you're good looking, which have nothing to do, you know, I mean, obviously being good looking has nothing to do with any of those attributes, but we have this bias that we associate, you know, something that is aesthetically pleasing with all these other positive attributes. So now combine this with AI and AI beauty filters. So with AI beauty filters, everyone can be beautiful. So then what happens? Does this mean that everyone becomes intelligent and everyone becomes trustworthy and everyone becomes sociable? No one has really looked into that. So why are one of the first groups that is investigating that? And then, of course, this also has the implication of what happens when we are interacting with AI chatbots or AI agents, you know, or AI avatars. Does this mean that if they are good looking, we will trust them more?
Yeah.
And we will believe them more? Does this mean that we will be more susceptible to manipulation by them then? I mean, there is all these questions that we still don't know, you know, what the answer is. So we are also very interested in the cognitive bias side of things, not only on the algorithmic bias side of things.
Yeah. I mean, that's not something that I was aware of. And I love even the way that you're describing that is making it sound so interesting and so necessary. So again, coming back to that idea of that, or what I said earlier, but there's a clear passion there for your work. And I can understand why you were, you became an ACM fellow. And I just want to mention that because it was somebody in the ACM who put us in touch with each other.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, Nuria, I've learned loads from speaking with you for the last while. So thank you for that. So the ACM Happy fellowship, it's as I said, the top 1% of ACM members, and it's a kind of recognition of their achievements and their work. I mean, does that kind of stuff mean anything to you?
You mean the ACM Fellowship?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, I was just like, wow. I mean, it's an amazing recognition. It's very hard to be recognized as an ACM Fellow. I think there aren't that many ACM Fellows, for example, from Spain. Mm. I don't know if there is any other female ACM Fellow from Spain. I'm not sure, like in Spain. So it's really a very prestigious, you know, recognition. And it's always, I think, positive to get sort of like external validation, you know, from your peers and from people that you respect and from people that, you know, that inspire you. And so, yeah, it's definitely a very meaningful recognition. The event is also very nice, the event where they, the ceremony where they induct us, so to say, being fellows, is usually in San Francisco and it's together with other awards that the ACM gives. And yeah, it's a great honor, you know, and it makes you feel also kind of like the responsibility of like, oh my God, you know, I have to like continue doing interesting work. And I hope that I don't, you know, that I don't disappoint. And I've also been serving the ACM for many, many years. I do think that scientific service is a big element of being a scientist, you know, service through different committees, helping organize conferences. And actually this past year, 2023, I served as the president of the ACM Fellows Committee. So I was on the other side of the process and, you know, I could see how rigorous and competitive the process of becoming a fellow is. So yeah, I feel really lucky that I was selected to be an ACM Fellow.
Well, Nuria, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I genuinely mean that. You've made me want to think. You've made me think about so many other things that I haven't thought about before, and you've made me want to read and
awesome.
Watch things and try different things. So I applaud your inspiration. If somebody wanted to find out more about you or your work, what's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, so I encourage you to go to the Ellis Alicante website. It's Ellis Alicante, E-L-L-I-S, Alicante, A-L-I-C-A-N-T-E altogether.org. It's a new nonprofit foundation and I'm very passionate about what we work on and what our mission is. And I would love to, you know, have more people join us or at least, you know about us. In terms of scientific output, you know, I mean, people can look in Google Scholar or even in the ACM Digital Library, you know, to get to know more about my papers and so forth. I do have a website, which is nuriaoliver.com, but I don't maintain it that much because a lot of the stuff is in Ellis Alicante. So there is stuff there too, but it might be a little bit, you know, outdated. And yeah, I'm not super active on social media, but I'm active. I mean, I use X or like Twitter. So I can also maybe know a little bit about this, but I don't really spend a huge amount of time on social media. And I don't have the time, I guess, for it. And of course, everyone, you know, they can also send me an email. The email is on the website of Ellis Alicante.
Excellent. Well, Nuria Oliver, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it. And I hope one day that we'll speak again soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this lovely conversation. Thank you for the interest in my work and in my profile. And yeah, congratulations also for your program.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Machine. As I said at the start, there are some links in the show notes if you'd like to dig a little deeper into Nuria's work. You can also find me online. I'm at RobO'Connor_IRL on most social platforms, though to be honest, I don't hang around there very often. You can also find me on the Southeast Technological University website. We'll be back with another useful tech talk soon. Schlange Fall.